Chapter 5, The Early Settlement of North Carolina. George and Anne Marwood Durant were the most notable first settlers of what became North Carolina. The Durant House was more than a family farm. It was also a tavern and a store, and host to some of the first significant political events in our early history. So important were the Durants to the founding of North Carolina that each new governor is given the chance to take the oath of office on the Durant Family Bible. In January of 2013, Governor Pat McCrory included this historic book among the stack of Bibles on which he took the oath of office. George Durant was a man of many talents. He often referred to himself as a mariner. He was frequently at sea, carrying to market the goods he and his neighbors grew. He farmed as well and held a variety of public offices, including Speaker of the Assembly and Attorney General. Anne Durant, too, lived a remarkable life. Anne was a partner in the family business, which was essential when her husband was away at sea or preoccupied with concerns of the new colony. She was a clothes maker, at one time was a funeral director, and once was a jailkeeper. Anne even hosted the meeting of the assembly. Several times she appeared in an official capacity before the general court, representing her absent husband. This makes her the first practicing female attorney in state history. Together, the Durants managed a farmstead of more than 2,000 acres. They had 9 children, 8 of whom lived to adulthood, and 6 of whom had families of their own. This occurred at a time and in a place where typically fewer than half of the children born would live to old age. George and Anne Durant demonstrated a tendency to want to govern their own affairs and to run their own lives. This was a trait that many North Carolinians after them shared. Section 1. Early Settlement and Proprietorship. As you read, look for why early settlers became known as rogues, how the Lord's proprietors came to possess the Carolina colony, the lifestyle of the early settlers, conflict and rebellion in the colony, and the following terms. Neck, Lord Proprietor, Customs Duty, Quitrent, General Assembly, Navigation Acts, and Culpeper's Rebellion. One of the most unusual places to live in North Carolina is on a neck, a peninsula located only in the northeastern corner of the state. It was in these peninsulas, where land is surrounded on 3 sides by water, on the northern shore of the Albemarle Sound, that the colony of Carolina had its origins. From the 1650s to the early 1700s, the people of the Albemarle made homes for themselves, fought over who would rule them, and developed some feisty, not afraid to fight or argue, attitudes about government and authority. Beginning in 1663, the Carolina colony was owned by English aristocrats called the Lord's Proprietors. The proprietors and their colonists seldom got along. Settlers from the North. After the failure of the Roanoke colony, the English waited until 1607 to establish their first permanent base in the New World at Jamestown. A prosperous, tobacco-growing colony of Virginia grew up around the James River. Few settlers came south into Carolina, the name given the former Roanoke colony. Virginia's Chesapeake Bay was deeper and easier to navigate than the shallow Roanoke Sound. The overland way to Carolina was hindered by the Great Dismal Swamp, a stretch of cypress, cedar, and standing water that extended more than 30 miles along the eventual border between the colonies of Virginia and Carolina. Profits to be made from tobacco eventually spurred interest in lands below the Dismal Swamp. Tobacco severely leached, pulled the nutrients out of, the Virginia soil. After 7 years, a field had to be abandoned. Farmers were always looking for more land. In 1622, a Virginia official, John Pory, waded through the swamp and went all the way to the South River Chowanock, some 60 miles, where he found a very fruitful and pleasant country. In 1629, King Charles I gave a patent, or royal permission to use, a large tract of land south of the Dismal to his Attorney General, Sir Robert Heath. The Heath patent went unused, as Englishmen concentrated their efforts on the lands of the Chesapeake. By the 1650s, the best Virginia lands had been taken, and tobacco prices had fallen. George Durant and others looked to the Albemarle, hoping they could grow more tobacco there with less effort and expense. Sometime in the 1650s, Durant and his partners in trade with the Indians, Virginians Richard and Nathaniel Batts, explored the area. Richard stuck to the sea, while Nathaniel and George took out some of the earliest deeds in the area in 1660 and 1661. Durant and his neighbors were also speculating on land, buying land in the hopes that prices would rise. Carolina Rogues. Available land wasn't the only reason the Albemarle Sound beckoned new settlers. Tax evasion, or the attempt to avoid paying taxes, was another enticement. A lucrative tax on tobacco, collected as customs duties, fees paid when a good was shipped out of a port, had become a means for England to support its New World colonies. Virginians were constantly watched to make sure they paid their taxes. The first settlers to the Albemarle developed a reputation for being rogues, cheaters, because they often shipped their tobacco and other products through back channels without paying the tax collector. Someone like George Durant could make a profit by growing his own tobacco and buying up his neighbors, then arranging to ship the tobacco on small boats that came down the coast from New England. Unlike the large English ships that sailed the Chesapeake, these Yankee sailing vessels could cross the shallow sounds, then head back north along the edge of the Gulf Stream with small cargoes of tobacco, corn, and wheat. A Boston merchant could combine several boatloads of produce into a larger shipload that would bring a profit in England. For several years, the Durants and their neighbors did well, and others joined them. Their success was helped by the uncertain status of their property. Were they part of Virginia or part of the new colony of Carolina? It would take years to decide the matter, and the contentious character of the colony would be established. Special feature: Carolina Places, the Great Dismal Swamp. When the Albemarle area was being settled, about the only way to reach it by land was to go through or around the Great Dismal Swamp. The place was lush with vegetation, but many residents of the early Albemarle were afraid of going very far into the swamp. A typical swamp is a low-lying part of the earth where water stands much of the year. It stays swampy because the water creates muck in the earth, which in turn fosters more growth of plant and animal life. The Dismal Swamp, in contrast, is more like a big Pocosin, a swamp on a hill. The Dismal is actually higher in elevation than the surrounding tidewater area. The swamp's foundation is peat, a spongy form of decayed plant life that is a forerunner to coal. What is really strange about the Dismal Swamp is that water flows out of it, but not into it. Its water comes from thousands of springs that rise up through the peat, but no one is exactly sure of the spring's source. Seven short rivers flow out of it and into either the Chesapeake Bay or the Albemarle Sound. Near the middle of the swamp is freshwater Lake Drummond. The Dismal has some of the most famous water in American history. Because it filters up through the peat, the water is sterile and clean. Tannic acid from juniper and cypress trees keeps it fresh. In past centuries, Dismal Swamp water was barreled and taken on ocean-going ships, including those that took Admiral Matthew Perry to Japan in the 1850s. Coastal residents thought the brown juniper water would keep a person from getting malaria. Slaves escaping on the Underground Railroad could hide in the swamp and not get sick from drinking the water. Over the years, people of all types have tried to get a piece of the Dismal. Most of all, it has been timbered. George Washington invested in a company that was formed to cut into the swamp, make money from its timber, and turn its peat into farmland. Although Washington's company dug a lot of drainage ditches, it did not level the forest. In the late 1790s, Washington and others began digging a canal through the swamp from the Chesapeake to the Albemarle. When this was completed in the early 1800s, people in northeastern North Carolina had an outlet to the sea. The canal was a major reason that the richest North Carolinians of that day lived on the nearby Roanoke River. It also spurred the growth of Elizabeth City. The canal is still in use today. In the early 21st century, the swamp is one-third the size it was when the first white settlers came to the Albemarle. Half in Virginia and half in North Carolina, it is preserved as either a state park or a wildlife refuge. The Carolina Charter. Every one of Great Britain's American colonies was eventually organized by a charter, a contract granted by the king to individuals or groups who were to be in charge of settlement and then govern the settlers. Virginia was established through a charter to the London Company, which established Jamestown in 1607, hoping for financial profit. Despite the popularity of tobacco, early Virginia did not succeed, so the company sold its interest back to the king in 1622. These legal transactions canceled out the old rights to Roanoke held by the Raleigh interests. Thus the Durants and others on the Albemarle still lived in Virginia. In 1663, King Charles II of England created the new Carolina colony. Charles II's father, Charles I, had been executed during a long civil war in which the monarchy was abolished. Charles II was restored to the throne in 1660. The new king owed favors to those who had put him back in charge, so he gave a group of English aristocrats the southern part of Virginia. On March 24, 1663, 8 lords proprietors received the Carolina Charter. In 1665, the king expanded their charter to include all the territory that is North and South Carolina, Georgia, and part of Florida today. The proprietors also had claim to all territory west to the South Seas, the Pacific Ocean. Although no one at the time knew just how much land was involved, the Carolina colony claimed most of what became the southern half of the United States, extending all the way to California. The Lords Proprietors. The Lords Proprietors were some of the most powerful men in England. For example, George Monk, the Duke of Albemarle, was master of the King's Horse, which meant he commanded the English army. Anthony Ashley Cooper was Chancellor of the Exchequer, which meant he was National Treasurer. Why would these men even want a colony so distant from their London homes? Money was the answer. Like a real estate developer of today, they wanted to sell the land and earn their money through financing the deal. To encourage settlement, the proprietors almost gave the land away, charging mostly for surveying, measuring, the property, and filing the deed. But they expected each year to receive a quitrent, an old form of payment that had existed for centuries in Europe. The owner held title to his land but had to pay an annual land tax to the proprietors. This could have gone on forever, even for the settlers' descendants, because only a portion of the quitrents would be used to maintain the colony. The proprietors hoped to reap a great profit over the coming years. The proprietors saw this as a good deal for all concerned. In return for the revenue from quitrents, they were obligated to govern the colony fairly. The concessions of 1665 required them to protect the colonists from invasion and attack, and to give the colonists the same liberties, franchises, and privileges that were given in England itself. A key phrase in that document was that all taxes were to be reasonably assessed by and with the consent of the free people living in the colony. In 1669, the proprietors approved a document called the Fundamental Constitutions. This document established a form of government run by men with an elaborate series of titles and ranks, like caciques, landgraves, and yeomen. At the top rank was the Palatine, who came from the ranks of the proprietors, but who ran the colony from England. The proprietors hoped that establishing order in the colony would help everyone involved, but as it turned out, rogues had very different views about society than landgraves. The Albemarle region turned out to be the least profitable and governable part of Carolina. Poor access to the sea hindered economic growth there, and the social attitudes of the early settlers often diminished the proprietors' efforts to get results from the northern necks of their colony. Social and economic conditions. Most Albemarle settlers were not nearly as wealthy as their Virginia counterparts. They typically lived in wood frame huts that rested on cypress piles. wooden pegs substituted for expensive nails. Most houses had one or two rooms, with a loft above and a chimney for cooking and heating. Families used the main room as a gathering place where they mixed work and play on a daily basis. Most early farmers did not even own a plow, but used hoes and shovels instead and sowed their tobacco plants by hand. They sold their tobacco, corn, and other crops at a small profit to the New England ship captains who came to the Albemarle each summer. Most early Albemarle families did the labor themselves. Only about 1 in 10 settlers was an African slave. Still, many settlers got by with the least effort they needed. This inspired the derogatory nickname often given to them, lubbers, referring to someone with lazy habits. Some Virginians call the Albemarle Lubberland. There were no churches or schools in the first neighborhoods. People worshipped in homes, especially members of the Society of Friends, Quakers, a new religious faith that had recently originated in England. Because Quakers did not need to have a minister to conduct a service, no clergyman was in residence in the Albemarle for years, and no meeting house was erected until after 1700. Unrest in the colony. The so-called lazy lubbers of the Albemarle reacted energetically to any effort by the proprietors to impose order on them. They had little desire to pay the quit-rent and little use for the fancy titles of the few rich people in their midst. In fact, the Albemarle settlers were very assertive of their independence from the start. When the proprietors convened the first General Assembly, the lawmaking body made up of representatives from the various necks, one of the first laws it passed was a declaration that land deeds already held by the inhabitants be respected. The representatives also insisted that they pay quit-rents at the same rate as in Virginia. The proprietors approved these ideas in 1668 with the Great Deed of Grant. Culpeper's Rebellion. Albemarle citizens showed their independence again in 1673 when the proprietors decided to enforce the Navigation Acts, laws passed in the 1660s that listed which colonial goods would be subject to customs duties. This new enforcement meant that many Albemarle residents who sold to New England shippers would no longer avoid the duties. Most of the Albemarle residents would not pay. The proprietors tried to stop the tax evasions, but their first tax collector let most of the ships depart without checking their cargo. Some residents of the Albemarle sided with the proprietors, often for selfish reasons. Thomas Miller, who was an apothecary, druggist, wanted to be the tax collector so he could receive a portion of the duties as his fee. Also, if tax evaders forfeited, lost, their property, people who sided with him could buy up the forfeited land and resell it for a profit. Miller's ally was surveyor Thomas Eastchurch, who could collect more fees if land was sold. Miller and Eastchurch brought about an event that was called Culpeper's Rebellion, even though John Culpeper was only a minor player in the drama. In 1676, Miller and Eastchurch went to England to describe the deplorable situation in the colony. George Durant also went there to plead that limited access to the sea made the settlers too poor to pay the duties. To please the king, the proprietors appointed Eastchurch governor of the colony and made Miller the tax collector. However, when their ship docked in the Caribbean on the return trip to Carolina, Eastchurch stayed there to marry a rich woman. Miller went on to the Albemarle, arriving in 1677 on a small ship he had armed to help collect duties. When George Durant returned from London, Miller tried to arrest him, but within days, Miller and his followers were put in prison. In the midst of the chaos, Eastchurch finally arrived. As official governor, Eastchurch could charge Durant and his rebellious comrades with treason, the act of trying to overthrow the government. But Eastchurch became sick and died, and the fight resumed. Both sides sent complaints to the proprietors in England. Fearing that the king would think they were ineffective and would take the colony back, the proprietors sent Seth Sothel to be governor. But on the way, Sothel was captured by Turkish pirates and was taken away as a prisoner. The proprietors appointed John Harvey governor. Harvey began to send some quit-rents and customs duties back to England. Then Harvey died. Thomas Miller escaped prison, went to London, and once again told the proprietors he was the real leader of the Albemarle. By 1680, with so many competing stories, the king had to step in. A hearing was conducted about whether to revoke the Carolina Charter. The desperate proprietors decided to blame Miller for the whole matter because Durant and others were the taxpayers. In 1683, 4 years after his kidnapping, Seth Sothel finally arrived in the Albemarle. Sothel took land titles away from residents who angered him and jailed anyone who disagreed with him, especially George Durant. Angry Albemarle residents imprisoned Sothel, then set up their own court to force Sothel to leave the colony. The Gibbs Rebellion. The Albemarle continued to have troubles even after the Sothel affair. A resident of the Currituck Neck, John Gibbs, led a small rebellion that tried to stop the new governor from taking office. This Gibbs Rebellion, however, was short-lived. Gibbs' neighbors made him flee into Virginia. The colony is split. In 1691, the frustrated proprietors split their colony in two. They told the governor to live in Charlestown, where customs duties on rice were substantial. A deputy governor of North Carolina was sent to the Albemarle. That governor, John Archdale, was a Quaker and largely left the Albemarle region alone.